When my mother talked about menopause, she called it the change. And it was all hush-hush, as if there was something wrong about something so natural. Thank goodness, with mental health awareness and recent exciting research, we're beginning to understand the huge role hormones play in women's bodies. Being postmenopausal like me has its challenges, but if you're going through either perimenopause or menopause, then you need to try Hormone Harmony. Why? Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier, and that means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it shows. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code SELFWORK at checkout. That's Happy Mammoth, HappyMammoth.com, and use the code SELFWORK for 15% off today. This is SELFWORK, and I'm Dr. Margaret Rutherford. At SELFWORK, we discuss psychological and emotional issues and what you can do about them, whether that's learning self-acceptance, taking action, or seeking therapy or treatment. 8 years ago, I extended the walls of my practice to reach those of you who might already be knowledgeable about mental health treatment, but also to those of you who might say you'd never darken the door of a therapist. And yet, you are here. I'll answer your questions while I invite you to take a few minutes for your own self-work.
It just really came out of the blue. He's highly successful, happy, super responsible, pillar of the community, always volunteering, always involved, you know, ran his own company.
Sure.
And, you know, he just was always our rock.
Welcome to this week's edition of Self-Work. I don't quite remember when Penny Gray and I first talked. It was after 2019 when Perfectly Hidden Depression was published, but not long after. Penny is the widow of a man, Dave, who tragically fit the rubric of Perfectly Hidden Depression almost frighteningly well. She tells the story in the interview about how she happened upon the term Perfectly Hidden Depression when she was seeking some kind of understanding about the why of her husband's death. I'm honored to share her story with you as told by herself and could think of absolutely no better person to feature on our 400th episode. But let's talk about that whole 400 thing for a second. When I began self-work in 2016, I learned that most podcasts, or a great number of them, make it to 8 episodes and 8 episodes only. So if you check those first 8 episodes, 2 of them on Perfectly Hidden Depression. I knew where my passion lay, and I was determined to use my podcast to get out the word as best I could. Now, 392 episodes later, we've arrived at 400. I have a fantastic team. John Crowley, audio engineer and producer extraordinaire. His studio is now in Utah. It's Loudmouth Studios. I still cannot believe that he listens to my voice every week, corrects mistakes, my cussing, my coughs, my mic mishaps, you name it. It happens, and he hasn't gone crazy or quit yet. Christine Mathias, who's been with me even longer than John, who makes so many things possible, it's hard to say exactly what she does. But for the podcast specifically, she makes graphics, she lines up guests, which is definitely like herding cats, and she keeps me organized, which is no small feat. Jody Smith, who's my podcast guru, leads me through all the technical aspects of podcasting and is a liaison between me and my advertising platform, or platforms we've changed several times. He's priceless and has dug me out of lots of issues. I have so much gratitude to all of them. They may be behind the scenes, but I definitely could not do this without them. In fact, the thought of that, well, let's just say it's far from pleasant. This next month, in fact, John and Christine are going to be compiling episodes that will be different for you, the listener. Once a month for now, but we're making the change while I try out recording more for YouTube. It's a new venture, but one that takes time, and I haven't been able to come up with more than 24 hours in the day. I think you'll be really intrigued with what they create again once a month, and that's coming in late July. But back to Penny. My respect for her is immense. She's fighting severe kidney disease now on top of everything else, but she has a passion to tell Dave's story. You'll hear just how hard it was for her and her children, as one minute she was texting back and forth with her husband, who seemed maybe to be having a moment, but saying he was fine, but who in hindsight had been planning to kill himself and did kill himself 15 minutes after finishing a text to her. What exactly was it that kept him from revealing his pain? What triggered that kind of commitment or need? She'll talk about what she's pieced together, while at the same time she's still reeling from questions and emotions that she deals with every day. Please realize that we'll be talking about suicide, and the suicide prevention information will be in your show notes. And now, very respectfully, I introduce you to Penny Gray, the wife and widow of Dave Gray, who is as dedicated as I am about spreading the word that people, even your partner, or your child, your best friend, your parent, anyone can keep secrets, while old demons can shout out reason and rationale, and a life that seemed perfect can instead be a camouflage for intense loneliness and unrevealed pain. Then a grieving family is left to try to understand what was so hard that you had to kill yourself. And there's no real answer, just speculation, wonder, and maybe a sense of something that's now more clear. Again, I'm truly honored to introduce you to Penny Gray. And just okay, if you can start out talking to us about how you found out about Dave's suicide and what it brought out in you, and how you contacted me with perfectly hidden depression issues or questions.
So we had maybe the 2 weeks prior to Dave's death, we had, you know, we had an idea that something was wrong, but okay, no further back than that. It just really came out of the blue. He's highly successful, happy, super responsible, a pillar of the community, always volunteering, always involved, ran his own company, had 21 employees relying on him.
Sure.
And, you know, he just was always our rock. He was very even keeled when it came to emotions, you know, no highs or lows, just a steady rock, basically. Steady. Yeah, very steady. And he was a Harvard Business School graduate. He was an engineer and then went to Harvard Business School, got into the transit industry and started his own company after a few years, and just led a great life, you know, was a great dad, very responsible and provided for us. Mm-hmm. But a couple of weeks before, he had won a huge contract with the Chicago Transit Authority, and everything was going great. It was going well. But a couple of weeks before he died, it came to his attention that the supplies that were coming in for this project,
right,
were coming in faster than his team could handle them. They didn't have enough warehouse space. It was a logistical problem, but nothing that my husband couldn't handle. He's handled far worse problems. This was not a big problem for him. But for some reason, he reacted to it like it was.
You said, when we talked back then, you said that there had been something that had happened in the past.
Yes.
Years and years before that.
Yeah, when he started his company back in, I think it was 2009. And, you know, just him and two business partners and a small team. And they very quickly got a large contract to overhaul subway cars or the transit cars for the Buffalo Niagara region.
Wow.
And they were there was a bigger, I won't say the name, but there was a bigger, larger company that was in charge of the whole project. But Dave's little company had, you know, they had a big role in it. They were actually subcontracted to do the tear down of the cars. And
okay.
Anyhow, it happened so quickly that they didn't have any other work in the pipeline. They were all focused on that. And they did their job great. They really did. But this larger company wasn't getting paid, or for some reason, I don't remember the details, they stopped paying my husband's company. And, you know, he wasn't a huge company where he just had lots of funds sitting around where he could, you know, make do. Long story short, I think the number was like, I think they owed him like $800,000.
Ooh, wow.
And for a brand new company, less than a year old, you know, not getting that money was a big deal. So that was the first time since I'd known him that I'd ever seen him depressed. He was truly depressed, but he still got up and went to work every day and tried to fix the problem. And he did fix the problem. Okay. He never got the money from the company.
Really?
But he went out and got other jobs, other projects. He and the business partners didn't take a salary for 6 months so that they could still pay their employees and keep them working. And he turned things around. And that was in 2010, but it was hard on him. Mm-hmm. And in 2021, when he started acting odd, when this logistical problem came up at work, I said to him, you know, you're scaring me. You're starting to act like you did in 2021.
So you saw the resemblance.
Yeah. Never in a million years thinking suicide, just thinking that he was getting really down on himself. And he told me, he said, yeah, I feel exactly like it was. So I think he had a fear that 2021 was, or that 2010 was going to repeat itself. And Dave could have landed on his feet anywhere, even if his company had failed, which it wasn't going to do. But even if his company had failed, he could have landed on his feet anywhere. But he was the type of person that worried about his employees. And, you know, so it was eating away at him. But still, there's nothing that would have ever indicated suicide. Nothing.
Right.
He was still going to work every day and trying to fix this problem. And it wasn't that big of a problem. It certainly wasn't like it was in 2010. They had plenty of money at this point. They had become very successful. It was just the logistical things that he had to work out.
But something got triggered in him.
Yes. And he had lost his brother to cancer in that time period. And just like with perfectly hidden depression, all those things he never dealt with. He just buried them inside. He buried his brother's death. You know, he handled it by helping his sister-in-law, by starting a scholarship fund in his brother's name. He handled it by doing things. Just like with the 2010 fiasco at work, he handled it by fixing it. Mm-hmm. He was a fixer. I don't know what happened in 2021 that was different. Even after he died, at that point, it was just him. He was the majority owner and he had a partner, but a third partner, David, bought out. I had to go back to that guy, good friend, and say, would you come back and run the company for me? And he, of course, agreed. And he got things straightened out. And, you know, I don't want to say I ran the company. I was in charge of it, but it's only because I hired him to do it. And I had good employees, but everything went great. And
there was no note. There was no note. There was
no note, nothing. But what this gentleman told me that I brought in to run the company is he said he was just following the plans that David already figured out a solution. And he had, you know, all of his notes. They weren't notes too rich, like I'm leaving, here's a note to you, but it was the plan for how to fix the situation. And Rich said, I just followed what he wrote down for me. And like I said, he didn't write it down for him, what he had written down. Dave had been writing down his plan. And so it was fixable. He already had the solution. But for some reason, he just I don't know what happened. And
well, I've talked to so many people, even since I talked to you. You are one of the first people that ever reached out to me. But there have been more, and they have the same question. Why was it that Tuesday? Why was it that month? What was going on that, you know, and no one knows the reason why. There's some theories, you know, suggestions, and that just, you know, and certainly I see in my own practice, just with normal depression or classic depression, as I call it, that someone can be going along and handling things pretty well, and then something just tips it over. Mm-hmm. And it becomes an unbearable kind of pain. Since you and I talked, one of the founders of the American, in fact, I talked about it in the TEDx, and you said you'd watched it. A guy named Edwin Schneidman talked about that the depression or the diagnosis of depression had less to do with suicidality than this idea, what he calls psych ache, which was, he called it unbearable, intolerable pain.
Yes.
And it's a very human response to pain. And it feels so unbearable. And this can happen obviously very suddenly that it's just, I'm done. I don't know how to handle this. And you know that I believe that that is often a function of years of, as you say, solving it with doing things, solving it with acts rather than expressing a lot of the emotions. I mean, his brother died. I mean, that, you know, all of these things that obviously are very sad and cause us to question. And what about anger, Penny? Have you been angry at all?
Yeah, I mean, I have my moments when I get really angry at him, because I was texting him, from what we can figure out, I was texting him like 15 minutes before he walked in the field and died. And he had sent me, he didn't write a note or anything, but I discovered in my email at about 1:30 that day or 1 o'clock that day, that he had emailed me a list of passwords for all of his accounts. And this is how unlikely it was, and not on my radar. He'd been acting depressed. He sent me a list of his passwords, and I still didn't think of suicide.
Yeah.
I texted him and I said, "Why did you send me this list?" And he said, "I just need you to have it." And then in my text back to him, I guess I must have had an inkling, but I still wasn't like jumping in the car to head mm-mm. home to find him. Mm-mm. I said, "Are you okay? You're scaring me," something like that. And he said, "Yeah, I'm okay." He literally sent that text and walked into the woods and hung himself.
Yeah.
And so I get angry because I asked him. Mm-hmm. All he had to do was tell me what was going through his head.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it was easier for him to take his own life than it was to actually talk to me about what he was feeling.
Or again, and of course, I don't know your husband, but people will tell me, I don't even know how to talk about it. It's not that I'm withholding from the people I love talking about it. I don't know how.
Yeah. And that doesn't surprise me. Dave's upbringing, he was one of four boys, Midwestern family. Dad was an orthodontist, but they also lived out in the country and had 400 acres of cattle farm and farming and workers. They worked hard, those boys did. But they were, you know, I don't know if it's genetic or just what, but they're not a family of emotions at all. Even at Dave's funeral, I don't think that I saw his parents are still alive or were at the time. They didn't cry. And, you know, I didn't see much emotion from Dave when his brother died. And I know when he was young, he had a very tragic death, a good close friend of his was driving the car in front of him on a windy road in Missouri, and she died in a car accident literally right in front of
him. Right in front of him. Wow.
And he, you know, he tells the story. He was the one at 17 years old that went to the mom's house to tell her. Mm-hmm. Again, that's another example of fixing things. Not that he was fixing it, but he was doing
the right thing. He was doing the thing, the stand-up thing.
Yeah, but it's just, there just wasn't much emotion. And I think I've told you that I was married before. I had two kids. I had a two-year-old and a, would have been a seven-year-old when I met Dave. He was 40, early 40s. And had never been married. He'd had long relationships, but they always wound up ending it because he couldn't commit to getting married. That was another, not in retrospect, that was another red flag that he didn't have that emotional mm-hmm. connection, wasn't able to fully commit like that. I, to this day, I wonder if we would have ever gotten married if I hadn't gotten pregnant. I got pregnant with our son, and of course, Dave did the right thing. Well, we're going to get married. You know, we'd been together 4 years at that point.
Yes, right.
But, and he was 46 when he got married and had his first child. I mean, that's pretty old, you know. or 45, I guess he was. I was 42. Or 46. Yeah, he was 46. I was 42. So, you know, just, yeah, there's just in your list of criteria or whatever, signs of right. perfectly hidden depression, that's a big one, that he just didn't know how to express emotion. He was a doer. He was the best volunteer, the best employee, the best boss. You know, just he checks a lot of those boxes. And sure. I had never heard of perfectly hidden depression. It was only after his death, and I'm a problem solver. I want answers. You know, after things had settled down and I was able to think straight, probably 2 weeks after.
That's miraculous right there.
The first couple of weeks, you know, it was pretty bad, but I wanted to know why, because it was so, I had family members and friends tell us that when Dave was missing, because he was gone for 24 hours before he was found, they were convinced that he had been murdered versus suicide. You know, they would have more likely believed that he had been kidnapped or murdered than suicide. I mean, the suicide just didn't occur to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
No. But anyhow, I told you I have kidney disease and I'm in a kidney support group on Facebook. And David started a new blood pressure medication about 6 months before he died. And so I went on there and I said, a lot of people with kidney disease have high blood pressure. And I just simply told them about my husband and said, he committed suicide. He started this medicine 6 months ago. Has anybody experienced depression on this medicine? And there were hundreds of replies, and I did not read them all. I was still grieving. I scanned them very quickly, and one caught my eye, and the woman said, look into perfectly hidden depression.
Oh, wow.
That's how I found out about it. And when I Googled it, that's how I found out about you. And then it was a short time later that I emailed you. That's how I found out about it.
Wow. Well, I'm, you know, there've been a lot of stories like that. I think I shared with you, the co-producer of TEDx Boca Raton also had a friend of a friend who had killed herself suddenly. And, her husband found my book on her bedside table. And that's why she got in touch with me. She said, what is this? Who are you? And we started talking, and I did some talks for a group that she headed up there in Boca Raton. And then she asked me to submit to TEDx. it's those kinds of things, Penny, that have just keep coming to me. I mean, I've been a therapist in Fayetteville, Arkansas for 30 years, and I've got this best, you know, I wrote this post called "The Perfectly Hidden Depressed Person Are You?" And I just pulled that term out of the air, and it has really hit home with a lot of people.
Yeah.
And I'm sad about that. I wish I didn't, you know, but it is at least given people like you some kind of theory, some kind of structure or scaffolding to try to put around this issue of someone I love very much and who I know loved me and loved his family. Mm-hmm. Still, something became so unbearable that he took his own life.
And it's not just helping me or others who have lost loved ones to suicide, but I mean, your work hopefully will prevent suicides because people will start to recognize themselves in these posts. In fact, I have a friend here in my town who lost her husband to suicide a few years before I lost Dave. And I think we've talked quite a bit. I think he had more of the hidden depression where I think he knew he was depressed and yes. He hid it from everybody. Mm-hmm. I don't think Dave knew he was depressed. I don't think he knew. And understood it.
One of the questions you asked me as I scanned our emails from years ago this afternoon before we talked, it's one of the questions you had for me. Did he know?
Did he
know how depressed he was? And my answer to that is probably not. And the more I've talked about it, read other books on perfectionism about it, there's this, there's something called high functioning depression or smiling depression that is more the way I view that is those folks do know they're depressed. They may have been to a therapist or a doctor and said, but they have either the characterological style, their personality style, the ability, their depression isn't so hard for them that they can function. But as you say, they know they're depressed. The thing that is a trait of perfectly hidden depression is that it is a learned response. It is a character trait that has been built because of the experiences that this person had in childhood. And it becomes that those things become who they are so much so that they'd look at you and go, well, I just don't cry. I'm just not a crier. You know, versus saying, no, I don't know how to cry.
Right.
Yeah.
And I don't ever want to assume anything about my husband's family because they're wonderful people.
I'm sure they're lovely. They're wonderful.
But, you know, there were four boys, and in between the oldest and the second oldest, they lost two babies to SIDS. And you gotta wonder, I think that they were already stoic people anyhow, but you have to wonder when you lost two babies and they weren't, I mean, not that it matters how old they were, but they were, I think, 6 months old.
Yeah.
I'm sure that a lot of emotions were stuffed down and that was the environment that they were raised in.
I'm sure. And again, you know, when I first started writing about this, I got accused of pathologizing resilience and courage and stoicism. And I said, no, those are, you know, the bravery and resilience that you can show, but it is when that is the only option. Right. When you always have to be resilient and you always have to cover up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have enough things like seeing one of your friends die in an accident in front of you and, you know, having infant brothers and sisters that died before you and, you know, getting to be 45 and never committing because you just maybe not didn't know how to do that. Those things add up. They add up. So what has your grieving been like? I mean, is it hard to know what to grieve?
Yeah, because with suicide, there's so much more than just grief. There's anger, mm-hmm. There's confusion, there's unanswered questions. And throw into that the fact that I had to suddenly take on this company and run it, you know, for a year and a half, or oversee it, I should say, and then get it ready to be sold. And that was a huge undertaking.
Sure was.
You know, I was dealing with, you know, commercial bankers and all sorts of attorneys and multiple accountants. I was thrown into this world that I didn't really belong in. So I had that to keep me busy, and that didn't mean I still cried every day and I was still grieving, but it kept me going.
Yeah.
And when I sold the company just a little over a year ago, it was very beginning of 2023 when I sold it, my depression got really bad.
I bet so.
Probably
it was also distraction. It was also distraction.
Yeah.
Sorry to hear that, but I'm not surprised.
Yeah. And, you know, after Dave's death, my son and I never stayed in our house again. Not that Dave died in the house, but he died on the property. We had been at our lake house when he died, and we just continued staying there. And we put the house on the market because neither of us wanted to live there again without him. Mm-hmm. And we lived at our lake house, which is about a 20-minute drive to school. And we lived there for a year and a half. But so I was busy with the company. I was busy with finding, I wound up building a house in town near his school. All that stuff kept me busy, and it all ended early last year. The house was done, the company was sold, and depression hit me hard.
I'm so sorry.
I'm finally getting to the point now where I can look at photographs and smile instead of cry, but I still, it's still hard. Hmm. You know, I just, because it just doesn't make sense to me. It just doesn't. And it's just hard to, like, I can't imagine families that lose somebody that disappears and they have no closure and they don't know where their loved one is. That must be the absolute worst kind of pain. But suicide is probably second to that, because you know the outcome, you know what happened, but you still don't know why it happened. And there's just so many unanswered questions. And that's the guilt part. Got the guilt, the questions, the anger. There's a lot of emotions involved with suicide. And even my friends, I have a good friend whose son died by suicide and a friend whose husband died by suicide. And they both got notes, but their notes didn't really help. The notes basically said, I can't live with this pain anymore, that I can't. And they're still, well, what pain? We didn't know you were in pain. You didn't tell us you were in pain.
Right.
Yeah.
How is your son doing?
Yeah, my son, my 16-year-old, is remarkable. He's the easiest kid to raise. He's just, I don't ever want to compare him to his dad, but he's a lot like his dad. He's just a good person and hard worker, excels in school. He's excels in sports. He's working on his Eagle Scout. He volunteers a lot. And, you know, I have to talk to him all the time about making sure that he doesn't tie his self-worth to things that he does.
Exactly.
And, you know, I did have him in therapy right after Dave died. We were both in crisis counseling, and the therapist released him and said he really is, he's doing remarkably well, but I still worry.
Well, yeah. I mean, of course you do. Of course you do. And the best thing that I know to, you know, to encourage you to do is to talk about your own anger and your own confusion and model that for him, that it's okay to have those emotions and talk.
Yeah, which I definitely do. And he knows I see a therapist, and I mean, he's definitely a high achiever. So I worry.
Yeah.
And my older kids are, you know, they love Dave like a dad. He'd been in their lives
sure a long time,
for almost 20 years, and they're doing okay. I've since become a grandmother. My daughter and her husband had a baby, and
congratulations.
They live a few hours away. My son is doing great. He lives in Charlotte, North Carolina, so about 10 hours away. Mm-hmm. That makes it hard too. I don't really have much of a support system. I'm supposed to be my son's support, my 16-year-old support. Mm. And sometimes I feel like it's the other way around because I don't have anybody here. You know, I've got, my kids are all, the two of them are grown and gone, and my closest friends all live out of town, and we stay in touch and we talk every day. But I feel like I went from having, you know, just this big close-knit family to, it's the normal middle-aged stuff. Your kids are growing and leaving, except I always envisioned going through it with my husband.
With Dave, yeah, exactly. So. With Dave. And that's different. It's just different.
Yeah.
Does your son know anything about perfectly hidden depression?
Yeah. Yeah. I've talked to him about it. I've shown them all the list of, you know, the 10 things, the 10 signs. My older kids, you know, different father, they're very good about showing their emotions.
Good.
Nick, I mean, right after Dave died, you know, he would definitely cry, and you know, he definitely wailed when we first found out that Dave had died. But I don't see him, like, I still get sad all the time, and I don't see that in him. And I don't know if that's okay or not.
Well, you know what? It's been 3 years. 3 years is what, a quarter of his life? So, you know, the amount of time he's not had Dave with him, given the ratio of how many years he's lived so far, you know, it's like a huge block of time for him. It's not all that long a period of time for you.
That's true.
I think your perception of it is probably very, very different. And
he does have one of his closest friends also lost his dad. He lost him to cancer, but they have that in common. And
good. Well, not good, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Somebody to have support with. So is there anything that you particularly did or that you find yourself doing now that you think is helpful, if anybody's listening?
Therapy. Absolutely, therapy. Mm-hmm. I actually started because, on top of the grief, once I had my kidneys fail and I had that to worry about, and I was worried about leaving my son as an orphan, I actually was referred to neurofeedback. So I've been doing neurofeedback. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to know if it's working because you're just kind of a passive recipient of it, but I think it is. I think it's helping. Probably the best thing that helps me, or the thing that helps me the most, is, and I don't do it very well, so even though I know it helps, is getting outside in nature. And not staying busy so that you forget about things, but finding purpose, you know, whether you have a job. I'm quote retired now since I sold the company, but I had started volunteering at the local hospital, and those things really gave me purpose and helped me to recover a little bit more, I think.
That's great advice. I mean, I just think that when you're around other people and you feel needed and you can see I'm not the only person in pain, and I mean, your pain is very unique. And
yeah, I actually started a grief group at our church too.
Good.
And that went really well. And it was just good to be with other people that understood.
There's a woman here who's a local OBGYN, and she lost a daughter in a car accident. And she started a group called Parents Left Behind. And it's been incredibly, I mean, hard for her, but also helpful for her.
Yeah. And the hardest part for anybody listening, the hardest part is taking that first step, because I would much rather sit on the couch or lay in bed all day. And some days I do that. It helps me to have scheduled responsibilities. If I don't have anything going on, I tend to just curl up in a ball and feel depressed.
There's another part of this that we probably should mention. I had a friend who lost her daughter, her 38-9-year-old daughter, 2 years ago this week. And she was talking to me, and this is very common with grief. I don't mean to sound scholarly about it, but the first year with certain kinds of deaths, you're obviously just such in shock. You know, there's no anticipation of it. She had no anticipation of her daughter's death. And like Dave's, so you're in this shock, and then you're living out the second year, and it's like this new normal that you don't want to live. And you have, it's harder, and you don't get as much support, and it's harder. And then even sometimes I've had people say the third year is like everybody's forgotten.
Oh, yeah.
That's exactly everybody's it. Life is going on, and, you know, they go, oh, yeah, you know, it's this afterthought.
Yeah, that first year, you know, I would post something about Dave every couple weeks or something, a memory or whatever. And I felt like that was allowable. Mm. You know, it was the first year. I don't do that anymore, because unless it's a big event, like Nick's soccer team won sectionals, and I posted a picture of Nick and I, and I said, you know, Dave, you should be here for this. But otherwise, I don't post anything like that, because I'm 2.5 years out, almost 3 years out. I shouldn't be grieving like this anymore. And
well, let me tell you very quickly. Yes, you should. You know, it's very normal. Very, very normal.
I just figure people don't want to hear about it anymore.
You probably are right about that. You know who the friends that can tolerate that are the friends that are still asking you how you're doing.
Yeah.
And sometimes the people that you think will do that, they don't, and people pop out of the woodwork who can, and you're just so grateful that they at least acknowledge what you must be going through, and people like that make a lot of difference. But most people, their own fear about their own lives getting out of control is, whether they recognize it or not, is going to get in their way of attending to you. And I mean, across the board, I don't know how many of my patients over 30 years have said, whether it's a divorce or a rape or a death or a tornado or an illness or whatever it is, it's like, okay, well, aren't you over that, you know, in the past? So,
Yeah. And I don't think they realize that it's an everyday absence, a hole that just doesn't get filled. When my kidneys failed in November and I was sent by ambulance to the hospital an hour away from here, I was alone.
Yeah.
That's something that my husband normally, he would have been right there with me.
Sure, of course.
But I was alone. I had to have my parents stay with Nicholas. He was 15. And I spent 4 days in the hospital by myself getting all of these tests, and you know, it's stuff like that that people forget. If you have your spouse, you have your support system still.
Yes.
And it's hard not to have that.
Yes, it is. Thank you so, so very much.
You're very welcome.
Please, if any of you really resonate with Penny's story, if you yourself are walking in Dave's shoes, or if you know someone who you think may be walking in Dave's shoes, please reach out for help. You can contact me at AskDrMargaret@DrMargaretRutherford.com. You can reach out to a local therapist. Talk about perfectly hidden depression, because some will not know what it is. People have come to me who have identified with perfectly hidden depression, and they've been able to talk about a pain that literally they never believed they would. It can be vital to life itself. Thank you so much for being here once again. It's such an honor to have you here as well. Please take care of yourself, your loved ones, and your community. I'm Dr. Margaret, and this has been the 400th episode of Self-Worth.